Chapter 30. Nike. Styx knows Ares needs help. Hades knows this. Charon knows this. Persephone knows this. Icarus knows this. Athena, Hephaestus, Aphrodite, Hera, Artemis, and Apollo know this. Possibly everyone who's not Zeus knows this. But there's only so much any of them can do. Hades and the underworld is always a place that he can come to, a place for him to rest. Ares will go to his brother's volcanoes and soak his aching muscles in the magma. Artemis finds him on the battlefield. Apollo plays him to sleep. Hera turns the tide of wars by whispering in the ears of mothers and wives. But it's not enough. There's so much war in the lives of mortal men, and Ares struggles to shoulder it all, to endure it all. Athena had helped the most. Having another war god to share the load helped. And it's not like Athena is displeased with her increase in followers. But the wars didn't stop or even end more quickly. And if they weren't all praying to Ares, they were still praying for aid in war. Styx wants to do something to help, but she's tied to this river, to this place, and she doesn't mind exactly, except, of course, for when she does. That's okay. The underworld is where everyone ends up one day, and there's someone right here who can help her. She's not afraid to go into Tartarus. Her river flows even there, and unlike those who are imprisoned there, she can leave whenever she likes. But just because she's not afraid doesn't mean she likes it. Doesn't mean it's a place she goes often. The edges are lined with active volcanoes, and the light of their magma is all there is to see by. Those titans who retain their sanity, their personhood, are in the center of Tartarus. Those on the edges are more monster than god. They tend to eat every soul that they find that's less powerful than they are. And Styx wouldn't say she's less powerful, but she is differently powerful. And she doesn't want to have to call out for Hades to save her. She can't die. She is the space between life and death. But being consumed by a titan isn't something she wants to experience regardless. Unfortunately for her, the titan she needs isn't the type to hang around the center of Tartarus, not causing trouble. He's right on the edge. He's always looking to cause trouble. Pallas is large, even for a titan, standing at the same height as a giant, so big that Styx could stand in the palm of his hand. His skin is mostly intact, but it's stretched taut over his bones, and his mouth looks like it's filled with jagged glass rather than teeth. "What does the goddess of the River of the Dead want with me?" His breath comes out putrid and rotten, like something died in it. Probably several somethings did. She wrinkles her nose. "I need to create a person, and I want your help to do it." She's a child goddess, and she can't bring about a child like other goddesses can. She may be one of the oldest beings in the universe, but it doesn't change her body or her mind. Doesn't change the fact that, in many ways, she's just the age she appears. Besides, even if she was old enough to conceive a child, Pallas wouldn't exactly be her first choice. Pallas laughs, sending more of his rotten breath into her face. "Why should I? Why me? You're powerful enough to make a person all on your own." "Any being I make on my own will be of me, will be a piece of what I am, and that's not what I need," she tells him. "You are the Titan god of Warcraft, of battle campaigns. I want your power, and I want your domain." He leans over, his eyes as large as a wagon wheel, and soon all that she can see. "Direct little thing, aren't you? You still haven't told me why I should help." "Why not?" she counters. A piece of you will be walking the earth once more, a reminder of you to fly in the face of all the gods who stole what you had. Why wouldn't you want that? He makes a motion with his face that Styx thinks is supposed to be a smile. And if I refuse, you'll take it by force, is that right? You could take me on your own, and even if you couldn't, Persephone could. It's true, she wants to do this on her own as much as she can, because she doesn't want anyone to try and stop her. But if she asked Persephone or Hecate or Hades or anyone else in the underworld for help, then she'd get it. It'll work better if you give it willingly. Pallas laughs. Very well, little girl. But remember this. You asked me for something, and I gave it. He raises his hand to his mouth, bites his thumb, and holds out his hand. Styx realizes what he's doing just in time to summon a basin beneath it, to catch the couple drops of blood that falls from his thumb. He's so large that it's enough to fill it, enough to fill a bath with, even if just the idea of it makes her stomach roll. Pallas has already turned away from her, lumbering in the opposite direction, and Styx peers down at the Titan's blood. It's not red, but black, the same consistency as oil. It'll do. She drags the basin to the edge of her river, not willing to risk any of her magic altering it by transporting it alongside her. She hasn't done this before, hasn't done anything like this before, and she's only going to get one shot at this, possibly two if she makes a small person. Now she's grateful that Pallas lurks on the edges of the Tartarus rather than in the center. It makes hauling the basin to her river a much shorter process. She can see other Titans in the distance, nothing more than hulking, dripping figures, but they don't come too close. She wonders if it's another favor of Pallas's, or just because they know that messing with her means messing with Hades, and their bloodlust isn't quite that self-destructive. Once she makes it to her river, it's easy enough to guide the basin upstream, until she's out of Tartarus, but not quite back to the innermost circle of the underworld where the palace is. It's in one of the many in-between places that Hades and Hecate have made, because she wants to be someplace where someone won't accidentally stumble across her. With a tug of her hands, the basin widens, doubling in size, and she uses her river to settle it on the bank of her river. Make sure she's on the side of the mortal world. She buries her hand into the earth of her shoreline, the soil damp and dark, and drops it into the basin. The blood bubbles and steams as the soil hits it, and it smells just as bad as Pallas's breath had. That almost makes her pause and reconsider what she's doing. But instead, she bends over to scoop up more soil in her hands to add to the basin. What she's trying to make won't come easily after all, so there's no reason to think that it's gone wrong. She keeps adding soil, and the smell gets worse, like sulfur, but she ignores it. She has to mix it together evenly, but she tries using a stick and it just evaporated as soon as it touched the bubbling mixture. Fine then. She plunges her hands in the mixture, ignoring the tingling on her skin. Her waters are more corrosive than a Titan's blood, but not by much. She beats the mixture until it's the right consistency, moldable but still keeping its shape, until it's more clay than anything else. And when she pulls her arms out, they're irritated and tinged purple, but her skin is still intact. Now for the hard part. She's no artist. She's not Athena or Hephaestus. She doesn't have an eye for beauty like Aphrodite. Helen, she says, and she doesn't use her powers often, but she's of this place more than anyone. She can command the dead just as well as Charon or Icarus. There's a ripple, and then Helen of Troy is standing in front of her, head tilted to the side. Yes, my lady goddess? Can you just... She bites her lips, looks down at her hands, then says, Can you just stand there? Helen raises an eyebrow, but says, Yes, my lady goddess. Styx forms the clay into roughly the shape of a person, eyes flicking between her creation and Helen. She's not talented, so she can't use talent to make this. Instead, she pushes her will into the clay to make it into the right shape, until she's got a copy of Helen standing in front of her. It's not exact. Her mouth is too wide, her nose too broad, her hips slimmer and legs longer. But it's clearly a person, clearly a woman, and it will have to do. Thank you, she says, and then dismisses Helen back to her home in the underworld. There's one more step to this, but she doesn't look just right. There's something missing. Icarus, she sighs, because she's exhausted and sore and wants to be done with this now. The whole idea had seemed much simpler in her head. She's not summoning him, just calling out for him. But there's no hesitation before he's beside her. Ink smudges on his hands, and his hair askew like he was running his hands through it. I'm in the middle of... He cuts himself off, and his eyes go wide. Styx, what are you doing? She tells him, and he shifts his weight from side to side, nervous. But he doesn't tell her that it's a bad idea, doesn't kick her creation into her river. She's missing something, Styx says. Icarus rubs his arms, but looks into the basin, then says, I have an idea. He's not as resistant to the effects of Titan blood as she is, and he winces and curses as he works, and several times he has to take a break to wait for the skin on his hands to grow back before he can continue. But he does continue, and even though it's been so long since he's done this, since he was trapped in the labyrinth, his movements are easy and confident. There's no more clay left in the basin, and on her back are two large wings, just like the kind Icarus was wearing when he plunged into the sea. It's perfect. Now what? He asks, and she stands in front of her creation. This isn't easy for her, to breathe life into something when death is all she knows. But she's not just death. She's the river Styx, the barrier between the living and the dead. So she is both living and dying and neither. She breathes in, goes on her tiptoes, and then breathes out. The air coming from her lungs is golden and sparkling, and when it touches the figure's face, it spreads until she's a figure covered in liquid gold. Then it all sinks in at once, the glow that's been surrounding her gone, but she's not clay anymore. Her skin is dark and her hair is the same shade, curled and falling to just below her chin. The lightest thing about her is her eyes. A soft brown. Well, except for her wings, of course. They're golden, unfurling from her back and spreading wide, and those soft eyes focus on her, and she says, Hello, Mother. Icarus shifts on his feet, and it must be as strange for him to hear this as it is for her. You know what I made you for? Yes. Because how can she not, when Styx pressed her intent into every inch of her? Go to Hera, she says. Tell her. She'll help you. Her creation nods, but Icarus coughs, and then in his hands is a short white chiton and a pair of sandals. She may be more amenable if you don't show up at her door naked, my lady. A smile curves around her lips, and she takes the clothes from Icarus's hands. Styx is running her eyes over her, looking for any mistakes, any sign that she was once soil and blood and not a goddess. But there's nothing. For her first time making a person, Styx thinks she's done a rather good job of it. Her creation takes several steps back, snaps open her wings, and then is soaring into the air, flying away from them and toward Olympus. Icarus is silent until she disappears from sight, then asks, Are you going to tell Hades, or shall I? Styx gives him a reproachful look. I really don't think that's necessary. I suppose, he says, and Styx is relieved until he follows it up with, it's not like he won't find out all on his own soon enough. She scowls and jumps in her river, where Icarus can't follow her and tell her true things she doesn't want to hear. Hera feels the moment someone dares touch her throne, and she's there the next moment, fury in her veins and power gathering in her hands, because whoever dares be so disrespectful of their queen is soon going to find themselves nothing more than a pile of ash. It's a woman, pretty but mostly unremarkable, except for the huge golden wings attached to her back. Hera pauses, mouth open, thrown enough off kilter that the woman has time to say, I apologize, Queen Hera. I needed your attention. You have it, she says. And there's power in this woman. Enough of it that if she's here to steal herself a seat on the Pantheon, she just might manage it. How could Hera have missed this? She steps forward, and Hera's prepared for a threat. But she doesn't offer one. Instead, the woman whispers in her ear, I was created to help your son, my queen, but first I need you to help me. A goddess cannot be truly formidable, cannot consider herself a true deity if she doesn't have a domain. And she was created to have one very specific domain. She doesn't have the time to build it naturally, but with Hera, she won't have to. Hera will speak her name and her dominion into existence, and it shall be hers. When she hears the details, Hera throws her head back and laughs. There's a grin curling her lips as Hera opens her mouth to announce her to the world. Ares is exhausted. It's not new or unusual, but his limbs feel heavy and his movements sluggish. A sword gets past his defenses and splits open his shoulder, and he doesn't even have the energy to wince. This battle has been raging for weeks, and he's been fighting for all of it. It feels like it'll never end, and he can't even slip away. The soldiers believe in him so deeply they call out his name in their sleep and give him offerings every hour of the day. No matter how badly he wants to rest, if only for a couple hours, he can't. Not when their belief pins him in place. Then the battle begins to shift. They've been struggling to hold this ground the whole time, but now they're gaining it, pushing their opponents back, and Ares lifts his sword with renewed vigor. They're winning. If they win, then maybe he can finally rest. You're welcome, a voice whispers in his ear. But when he swings around, sword outstretched, there's no one there. For some reason, his eyes are drawn up to the nearest tall hill, and someone is standing there, glinting gold in the rising sun. He thinks it's Apollo at first, but the silhouette is all wrong. He's beside her in the next moment, this goddess with dark skin and golden wings and an eager, greedy mouth. Who are you? I am who will soon replace you in the hearts of men, she says. Not all of them, perhaps not even most of them, but many. Their belief will make me stronger, and I will answer more of their calls, and even more of them will flock to me, until I'm as powerful as you or Athena. They pray to you, but what they really want is me. Who are you? He repeats, and there's something familiar about her, something he can't quite place, but that puts him at ease in spite of what she's saying. She smiles, tilting her head up towards the sun. I am Nike, the goddess of victory. Victory. Victory is how wars end. Victory is how he gets a chance to catch his breath. All his exhaustion is gone, replaced by joy, and he lifts Nike up by her hips, spinning as he holds her up in the air, her golden wings giving off a kaleidoscope of light all around them. As soon as he touches her, he knows why she feels so familiar. It seems he owes Styx a thank you. He wonders if she'll take him distracting Hades from whatever lecture he's intent on giving her as gratitude enough. Now that he'll have time to do it, after all.